before Scott comes to preach, I forgot to say two things. One is just a reminder that our
morning. Can y'all hear me? Okay. This is a new setup, as you all know. I have a new gift for staying the obvious. If you're visiting today, we've spent the past several weeks in the book of Ruth. We're kind of going to transition for the month of December. We're going to spend the month looking at the Matthean genealogy of Jesus. We're going to look at Matthew's introduction to the life of Jesus. It's interesting when you... I think that one of the things that we often have to do, I think I might have said this before on a Sunday morning at some point, but one of the things that I think is such a unique thing that we have to do all the time as modern people, post-Enlightenment, kind of Western modern people, something that most people did not often, if ever, have to do, is introduce ourselves. We regularly have to come in contact with people that have no idea who we are, that don't know what our parents did for a living, that don't know what we looked like as children, or how our noses caught up with our face in our middle school awkward stages, that didn't know our grandparents, that didn't know their trade and the way that they served the community and how that integrated everyone else together in life. We are so contextless often when we meet people. That's why I think this is one of the interesting things about something like Facebook, right, is you get a glance at your life or someone else's life, and you see all these people that are connected to you. But what's remarkable is oftentimes many of them aren't connected to each other. Pre-modern times, most people grew up, worked, worshipped, lived with, loved, married, buried the people that their grandparents did. So there wasn't this pressure to have to be able to tell your story or introduce yourself. Right? And when we do introduce ourselves, it's often by what we do. It's often tied to vocation or occupation, really. I think that the way that Matthew thinks and the way that the rest of the biblical writers think, that may not be the primary thing that would tell us the most about you. But it's your family, it's your lineage. It's your family story, not just your individual story, that would be significant and would give us a window into who you are. Now, we're sort of concluding with Ruth and beginning a few weeks in Matthew, because Ruth, as we've seen, is prominent in the story of Jesus. Which, if you look at Matthew's gospel and the genealogy in it, what's so unique is the inclusion and prominence of women. That most ancient genealogies were patriarchal, right? And it was the male and the descendants of the male and the name of the male that were significant. But Matthew includes several women, and they're all particular women with particularly unique stories that give us a window into who Jesus is. They are all the mothers of Jesus in many ways. Great-great-great-great-great-grandmother types, but they're mothers of Jesus. And the mothers of Jesus tell us something about who the Son is. And so with that being said, we'll sort of wrap up Ruth and talk about a little how it connects with Matthew. So let's pray. God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be pleasing and acceptable in your sight. You, O Lord, who are our rock and our Redeemer. Amen. Sorry, new presentation software. So we're getting the bugs out. There we go. I think there's three things that go on in this story. You notice in the beginning, after Boaz declares his intentions, there is this blessing, right, that the women hope for the family, that the folks hope will come through this union. Next is the birth of a child. Right, we see there that Ruth and Boaz conceive, have a child. And next, last, we see there's kind of a postlog, there's an epilogue, rather, to the story that tells us how this story of redemption connects into the broader story of this family and of all of Israel. So, first, we'll start with the hopeful blessing. One of the things that it's significant to, if we're trying to understand ancient Near Eastern culture, children are of the utmost significance, right? Being childless, I mean, infertility in any couple's life is something that is a painful existential dilemma that if you've gone through it, if you know people that are going through it, you know what a struggle it can be. Or childlessness, it can really be a challenge. It's exponentially more difficult in the ancient world. Because children are, for us, right, generally, children are actually an economic liability. Now, the parents here are laughing. Like, this is a young crowd. So the people in their 20s are like, what? Parents are like, yeah. Whereas in the ancient world, they're an economic blessing, right? If you're an agrarian society, the more hands you've got, the more money you can make. Oftentimes, having more children can actually increase your socioeconomic status and standing, right? A little different in modernity, right? So, and that's not to say that, which is one of the reasons why it's a significant choice to have children, right, in the modern world, because they often will complicate your socioeconomic life rather than make it easier. It will often not prosper you, but sometimes make it a challenge to prosper. But in the ancient world, it was, if you didn't have kids, right, if you don't have a lineage, if you don't have family, you are really cut off from some of the mainstream flow of resources of society. There's a real economic and social kind of marginalization, because as often people are prone to do, right, if people are going through hard times, or if you're going through hard times, maybe there's the temptation to think, well, maybe is God trying to tell me something? Right? Maybe this is God's way of uncovering some secret sin or something that I've committed. Right? Sometimes those narratives play in our heads. Well, don't be mistaken. That's certainly the kind of narratives that would run through the heads of people in the ancient Near East. So we have this blessing from the women of the town, hoping that Boaz, that now the house of Boaz would be blessed by children. And not just the house of, and not just Boaz and the increase of his household, right? But there's a significance also to Naomi. There's a significance for Naomi's story. There's this hope for the blessing. And when the child is born, after we hear this blessing, and then what's interesting is there's this blessing for children and for the prospering of Boaz's house, like the patriarchs, Judah, and like Rachel and Leah, calling back these matriarchs of Israel's history. Then we jump ahead. Right? There's this hope for their union and its fruitfulness. Then we jump ahead and we see the gift of this child comes. Now, of course, the author fast forwards here a little bit. It's sort of like a happily ever after type of ending here, right? Because in the course of a verse here, we go from this declaration for Boaz to take Ruth as his wife to the birth of this child, Obed. And what we have here is the birth of this child fulfilling in Naomi's life the existential and socioeconomic dilemmas she finds herself in from the beginning of the story. Naomi, 10 years before this, right, there's 10 years spent in Moab. The author of Ruth in the genealogy lists 10 generations of family. So it's interesting to juxtapose the 10 generations named in the genealogy with the 10 hard years in Moab, where Ruth loses her husband and her sons and becomes this widow without a lot of hope and prospect. It's interesting because the juxtaposition of tens there calls attention to the fact, I think, that those 10 years, despite the fact that they were exceedingly challenging, hard, depressing, they were times that caused Naomi to think, hey, I know my name means sweet, but call me Mara now because I'm bitter. Those 10 years were times that God was planting seeds that would blossom. And so I think the author is trying to tell us there with the relationship of the tens that maybe those 10 years in God's economy and God's unfolding of time actually meant something much deeper and more significant than Naomi could perceive. It's interesting that the women say to Naomi this, that Ruth is to her worth more than 7 sons. That this one who's clung to her, see, here's the thing that her hope would be, right? The whole hope of the Ruth story, the hope of the kinsman redeemer, is the hope of somebody who, in the midst of the situation of a widow, in the midst of the childlessness, in the midst of the lack of socioeconomic support and resources, someone that would come in and be able to be the mechanism for the provision of those things. But in many ways, who has been Naomi's kinsman redeemer? Ruth. Ruth has been greater than, and 7, of course, is the number of perfection here. Ruth is a greater blessing than 7 sons. Ruth is the one who enables Naomi's story to continue. And so when this child is born and placed in Naomi's arms, in the beginning of Ruth, Naomi says this, has this expression, I've gone away full and I've come back empty. I've got nothing. And it's so interesting because that's right after Ruth has said to her, I will stick with you for through thick and thin. Your God's going to be my God, your people, my people. I can't imagine what Ruth must have been thinking when Naomi says, look at me, I've got nothing. Nothing. And yet here, this child is put in her arms. Here is the redemption of her story. That her line will go on. That there is in the seeds, in this atmosphere of darkness, and oftentimes desperation, these seeds that were being planted are blossoming. There's a Orthodox rabbi who wrote an essay about Ruth. And in it he says, the scroll of Ruth exemplifies the redemptive power of compassionate memory. A child is born to Naomi, to Naomi's line. He shall be to you a restorer of life. This is not a messianism of muscularity, militarism, and conquest, but of redemptive compassion and revisioning, of spreading the corners or folds of the garment. This is why Ruth is the progenitor of the Messiah, because the Messiah is the ultimate Meshiv Nefesh, restorer of life and dignity when hope seems lost. The Messiah is the restorer of life and dignity when hope seems lost. It's arresting when you hear that scripture read, the genealogical parts of it, because I don't know how you are when you come across biblical genealogies, right? If you're in the Bible reading plan, but that's or something like, you know, you read the Bible in however many days. Usually the genealogies are like, okay, this is where I'm going to speed read and skim, right? And sometimes I understand that impulse, but James read it really well and slow. And when it goes from Obed to Jesse to David, we see that in the birth of this child, we don't just have the redemption of Naomi. It's the redemption of her whole story and of the story of Israel. That here, in this line, we would see, it's interesting, Ruth takes place historically, as we've said a few weeks ago, in the time of the judges, a time in the Old Testament when we're told that people do whatever's right in their own eyes, where sin is prevalent all over the place, and where it seems like that the redemption from Egypt is just not fully taking root or something. And yet it's in the midst of this, this ambiguous time, fraught with complexity and disobedience, that the seeds for David and for the Messianic line are being planted. And through who? Through a Gentile widow. What's so interesting about the story of Ruth is it's a story that is so much about insiders and outsiders. And we all know, right? We all know in every culture there are insiders and outsiders, right? We all know there are people that you want to be like and identify with and people that you don't. But if we're honest, most of us are oftentimes both, right? We to some people we're an insider, and other times we seem like an outsider. Oftentimes, you know, for instance, right, like in general, okay, white males are the insiders of the culture, right? And yet, tell me that a white male can't know at 13 in middle school what it feels like in some extremely painful ways, even as an adolescent, to be an outsider, right? Like all of our stories contain. Run in streams that include both insider and outsider. So with Boaz, because Boaz also has in his family line a mother of Jesus. Boaz's grandmother is Rahab, the Gentile prostitute who helps the Israelites in the period of the conquest, who the New Testament celebrates as someone who, in faith in Hebrews, right, aids the Israelites. I wonder if it's because Boaz knows, and you know, Boaz in this story looks like sort of the ultimate insider, right? He's the guy who's at the head of the threshing floor celebration. He's the guy who's sort of the big man on campus. He's the guy that has the capacity to provide for people like Naomi and Ruth if he chooses, these widows. And yet he knows, the insider, that deep in his story and central to it is a woman who's an outsider. Maybe that's what enables him to see in this Moabite woman somebody that maybe even though she is not coming from Israel's sort of socioeconomic and religious sphere naturally, maybe somehow the God of Israel is still at work in her heart, in her life. I think that the redemption that God brings, the means and the end are inextricably connected. The means and the ends are inextricably connected. What is God doing here? He's redeeming. We've talked about the past few weeks that the line of the Moabites are a line that come from this incestuous union of Lot and his daughters. And they're people that are strange, alienated from Israel. They're people that, you know, they're the outsiders. And yet, it's through bringing the outsiders in that the outsiders become insiders and the insiders become redeemed. And so it's not that, I think one way to sort of read a story like this is God's for the outsider, not the insider. No, it's that God means to use the outsider. God means to heal the suffering of the outsider. And through that healing, heal and redeem the insiders as well. So, I mean, I think part of what this text teaches us is that we ought to always be mindful. Who are the outsiders and insiders around me? Who are the people through whom God may want to speak? Who are the people I might be called to play a redemptive part in their story? And they mine. Always being mindful that our life always runs in both streams, insider and outsider. Matthew includes the story of Ruth in that genealogy to remind us that these women, Rahab, Boaz's grandmother, and Ruth, are part of Jesus' DNA. They're part of his family story. I want to talk about something for a minute. I normally wouldn't do this on a Sunday morning, but I want to talk about heresies for a minute. So I don't know, for those of you, if any people say like, oh, why do you go to church? It's anti-intellectual. You can tell them we talked about Ebionitism and fourth century heresies. Friedrich Schleiermacher, one of the deans of 19th century modern Protestant theology, said that there are really basically four heresies. He sort of narrowed it down, and I like that because there's a really long historical list, and he kind of makes it four. He says two of them are Christological heresies, and two of them are salvation heresies. The first one, docetism, comes from a Greek word, dokeo. It means to seem. And it says Jesus only seemed human. I mean, he looked like us, he walked around like us, he seemed deep, but really, he was just God with like a human suit on. He wasn't really human. Ebionitism is sort of the opposite. It says Jesus looks great, but really, he's just us on steroids. Like, the difference between us is not so much, it's not one of kind, but one of degree. And he's just a super good example. And if we just pull up our bootstraps, we can be like him too. Now, the latter two are a Manichaeism was a heresy, which Augustine actually came out of. And Manichaeism was a heresy that was dualistic and said that there were certain parts in the world that were good and certain things that were bad. And they were inherently so, and there were two different kinds of things in the world. And good and evil, and the evil stuff was irredeemable. And Pelagianism was a heresy that taught that basically we could sort of save ourselves. That God gave us all we need in the Ten Commandments, the example of Jesus. And if we just bear down, you know, grit our teeth, are pretty determined, we can run the race ourselves. Now, why Schleiermacher thought these were so significant is the first two negate Jesus as Redeemer. If he's only seems human, then he's totally disconnected from the mass complexity, sinfulness, and brokenness that we all transact in. And so what could he do from there? It's like he becomes Bette Midler's from a distance God. But if the Ebionites are right, then he's a fellow traveler and a fellow sufferer. And yet, like, he's just one more sufferer on the road adding to the suffering. The latter two are dangerous, he thinks, because they would tell us that there are certain parts of the world that don't need to be, that can't be redeemed. That there are bad people or bad places that are of a different fabric than the rest of us. And that they're irredeemable. The last one teaches that you don't need redemption, really. That you're in a fine state if you just would set your mind to it. You'll be fine. These are why he thought these were so destructive. Not because of ivory tower intellectual reasons, that they were, you know, he was a gourmet theologian and thought that we all needed our theological recipes right. He thought because they would just derail you spiritually. And what I think the story of Ruth tells us is why these heresies are so dangerous and why they're so wrong. See, Ruth's a mother of Jesus, Ruth and Rahab. Which goes to show us that Jesus' DNA, that the story that Jesus is connected to, is one that includes outsiders. It includes prostitution. It includes desperation, brokenheartedness. It includes all the messy things that make up the life you and I know and live in. And yet, Jesus is different in the midst of it. He's not just a fellow traveler. He enters into the story, almost like Neo in The Matrix. He enters into it and relates to the story differently. And in relating to it differently, becomes Lord of the story. And it teaches us that Manichaeism can't be true, that there are no irredeemable, that even this incestuous pagan people are near and dear to God's heart, and through God's providential machinations, he's going to bring them back into the family. But they must be brought in. You know what's so interesting? Everybody in the story needs somebody else. Naomi needs Ruth to cling to her, to wake her from her despondence, to allow her to keep going on. But without Naomi's commitment to Ruth, without her seeking Ruth's well-being and actually giving her the out, the sacrificial love shown to give her an out, Ruth wouldn't have known the compelling story of the God of Israel and been able to cling to Naomi. And they both need Boaz. And Boaz needs them. Boaz is unmarried. He has no successor. No lineage. Everybody needs one another. There's no one in the story that can redeem themselves. This is why these Christological heresies were, or these sort of ancient heresies were such a big deal. Because when you start thinking in one of these ways, you wind up thinking in ways that change the story of the gospel in ways that are so deleterious that they take you out of the embrace of grace. Nehemiah Poland says this in his conclusion of his essay. In the end, Ruth reminds us that nothing is more beautiful than friendship, that grace begets grace, that blessing flourishes in the place between memory and hope, that light shines most from broken vessels. What else is the Messiah about? Now, here's the interesting thing. I'll tell you, as we've gone through Ruth, I feel like I'm pondering writing a letter to Poland because I feel so in his debt. It's his stuff on Ruth has been more helpful than any Christian commentator I read. Not that they weren't helpful, but this was just more helpful. It's a pretty detailed essay. And yet, it's interesting that Ruth is to Naomi more valuable than 7 sons. It's oftentimes when you hear this story talked about, if you've grown up in the church, it's often Boaz is lifted up as the type of Christ, right? And there's some of that there. But it's amazing to me. I think the clearest type of Christ to me is Ruth. And yet, the son of Ruth can be worth to you 70 times 7 sons. 70 times 7 Ruths. And that's not to disparage Ruth. But the son of Ruth is ultimately the one. It's Advent season, and Advent just means coming, right? And it's the time we focus on the coming of Jesus and the Old Testament expectation of the coming of the Messiah. It's so interesting. As I was rereading the Ruth yesterday, I was thinking, you know, Naomi, in many ways, functions like a prophet. She sort of tells Ruth about the God of Israel. She points out where the kinsman redeemer is, right? Ruth in the story is more like the priest who goes and labors on behalf of another, who represents the case and interest of another. And Boaz is, in many ways, like a king, right? He's the one that protects Ruth. He's the one that stewards resources. He's the one that's the ruler in the story. And yet, it's the son of Ruth, the son of Rahab, who is the prophet, the priest, and the king, who is the one who ultimately answers the cry, as the old Advent hymn says, the cry of every longing heart. Naomi's hope, penultimately, in some small ways, was fulfilled by the birth of Obed. In ways she could see and in ways that she could not see. Like, she could see immediately, oh, my name will go on, I'm enfranchised, there's a kinsman redeemer for me. But she could never imagine that this little boy would be the grandfather of David. That he would lead Israel out of this time of chaos and anarchy and ambiguity into a fuller chapter of Israel's history. And yet, even David would be one who would need a son of Ruth. Even David would be one, as great as the messianic hope lived in David, even David would be the one. In Genesis, when Eve gives birth to Cain, the Hebrew is really interesting there, because she says, I've brought forth a man with the Lord's help. Or it could be a man the Lord, which is how Luther reads it. Because God has promised that the deliverance of Eve's progeny will come through her children. And every birth in Israel, every birth could be the one. Every birth could be the child that brings the hope and deliverance for every crying heart. And yet, it's the son of Ruth, the true son of Ruth, Jesus, the true Ruth. It's through him that outsiders and insiders are united in one flesh and one body in newness of life. That for which we long has been born. Thanks be to God.